And there's one brand that just offers something that no one else offers, right? Think about Google in search. Think about Facebook. Think about a whole bunch of kind of tech companies over the last 20 years, primarily software-based, where they were trailblazers in essentially kind of a blue ocean, and they were the only brand in town. Think about Tesla. In categories like that, they don't really have to actively position because they are the dominant brand. And this is primarily why Elon Musk, with all his kind of arrogance and bluster, said, I don't need to put money into advertising, right? But look what's happened. You know, let's say 20 years, you know, he didn't start the company, he bought into it. But 20 years after Tesla was started, OEMs have caught up within the electric car industry. There's a tremendous amount of competition now. Now, Teslas are being sold at discounts, and they're actively thinking about advertising, and now they're gonna have to think about positioning. So it's a wonderful example of, you know, when do we have to start thinking about having a positioning, being more clear around what differentiates our brand is in the presence of effing competition.
So as you know, I'm an employer brander. Now, while I generally work with talent acquisition folks, I love interacting with marketing folks. And what's interesting to me is when the marketing side has the same kind of challenges that I and employer branding have with talent acquisition. For example, even in marketing, it's not always recognized the deep differences between marketing and branding. They are radically different. They end up getting lumped in the marketing team, so everybody seems to think they're the same, but they're not. Which is funny, because when I think of employer branding and recruitment marketing, how incredibly different those functions are, but for the most part, TA leadership doesn't see the difference. So that's why I invited Faisal Siddiqui to have a conversation with me about marketing and branding. I first became aware of him on a podcast, the On Strategy podcast, which is a great marketing podcast, if that's your cup of tea. He was talking about challenger brands and the difference between brand and marketing, and it was like, of course, this is it. One, I'm thrilled that someone's having this conversation. Two, it's speaking directly to me as a brander. And three, it made me feel so good to hear that the quote unquote professional marketers out there who are spending millions and billions of dollars all day long, they're having the same challenges as me. It made me feel good. By way of background, Faisal spent a lot of time as a strategy director at a pretty hot agency before founding his own. It's called Creative Business Company. And if you're into this sort of conversation, I highly recommend you follow them because, frankly, their conversation of leveraging this 595 in-market, out-of-market conversation that we talk about today, they do a great job talking about it. So follow them on LinkedIn. So I hope you enjoy this conversation with Faisal Siddiqui. All right, my guest today is Faisal Siddiqui, who is a brand strategist. And Faisal, I've been reading and listening to your stuff for at least the last year. And I just want to start this whole conversation by saying thank you, because you've absolutely shaped my thinking of what brand is and what it can be for my own kind of employer brand work. So I really appreciate, you know, you being very open about your thinking and your approach. So it's been incredibly helpful to me.
Thank you very much. I think we certainly benefit from thinking out loud, and we make a certain, you know, when you think out loud, you make a bit of gaffes, and sometimes you land things that resonate. So appreciate all of your support, and thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. So in the work, you talk a lot about companies over-indexing on performance marketing. Performance marketing being materials that are designed to convert specifically. And they ignore the brand overall, the concept of the brand and how it shapes the market and how it sets up later successes. Can you give the audience kind of a primer on the difference between those kind of types of marketing and branding so that they kind of have a strong playing field to start with?
Absolutely. So I think the first place to start is the basic 95-5 rule. Yeah. And that came out of the Ehrenberg Bass Institute, which is the font of evidence-based marketing knowledge in the world. There's many different places, but they're one of the good ones. And there's a professor there called Professor John Dawes, and he talked about the 95-5 rule. And what the 95-5 rule says is that 95% of a company's lifetime revenue, or the revenue that they will likely accrue over their existence, is going to come from folks who are not actively shopping the category right now. And that kind of makes sense, right? Like, I'm not actively shopping for lots of things right now. I may be actively shopping for a few things, but the majority I'm not, which means I don't really have a need for those things right now. I'm not kind of weighing one brand versus the other. I'm not looking for discounts. I'm just being me. Conversely, there's 5% of a company's total revenue come from people who are actively shopping the category right now. So I think that's an efficient heuristic just to keep in mind, the 95-5. And that ratio and proportion can fluctuate slightly, but the delta is not huge. Yeah. Between sectors, between B2B, between B2C, even, you know, in the world of, you know, candidates and employer branding as well. But it's an effective heuristic. And the reason why I started with that is because it's a good way to think about the two different types of marketing. So the first type of marketing, let's call it brand marketing. And this is the type of marketing and advertising I suppose people grew up with and think about the Mad Men era. So it's very broad, it's very big, it interrupts you. And these types of big campaigns generally aren't trying to sell you something right now, but they're telling you a simple story about the unique value a company can provide. So a good example of that is the famous HSBC A brand positioning and B campaign around the world's local bank. So HSBC is a global bank. It's based in Hong Kong and Shanghai, originally from British extraction. And their whole positioning was this idea that they could help both retail and commercial customers bank better because of their local presence of their branch network in more places around the world. And so they articulated this positioning and this idea of the world's local bank. And they had these beautiful ad campaigns that ran for decades talking about how they really understood all of the local nuances, having a presence in all of these markets. So for all the business travelers out there, they'll remember all of the famous ads in the gates line, you know, going into your plane, where it talk about local perspective. So it's a football, it would show like an American football in the US versus a soccer or a kind of a UK football in different parts of the world in Australia. So that's what we call brand marketing, right? So they're not trying to they're not trying to sell me something. And we actually want to show it to a whole bunch of folks, whether they're in the category, not in the category, not looking for a bank or looking for a bank. And the reason why that type of marketing is so important is that when I do go in the category and I do create a business and want to look for a commercial banking partner, or if I do move countries and as a personal banking consumer, I am looking for a bank, then the HSBC brand is what we call top of mind. Yeah. And the brilliant thing about being top of mind is while it is expensive to get to that position, what happens is when HSBC is top of mind, when I do enter the category, I'm not even going to bother to search.
Yeah.
I'm not going to compare HSBC to anyone else. I'm literally just going to go to HSBC. McKinsey actually did an interesting analysis on the purchase funnel. Some of the things McKinsey says about marketing, you have to take with a grain of salt. Like these are people, these are people who kind of fire people for a living and prop up kind of corrupt South African politicians, and also, you know, push OxyContin. But
delicious. We all enjoyed it. What can I say?
Yeah, exactly. So, but sometimes, you know, on their day they'll do some good work. But anyways, even they said, like, they did analysis of the purchase journey and say it's kind of weird. Like, often what will happen is they'll go into a category with the brand. Like HSBC top of mind, they'll do some searches, they'll kind of go away, maybe compare it, but often will come back to the HSBC, to the brand that's top of mind.
Well, that top of mind effectively sets the frame through which they see the rest of the category. They understand based on, and you use one of my favorite words, if we were playing bingo, I would have rung a bell, but positioning, right? This idea that, you know, not every bank is the same, not every bank is for everyone. So how do you say, to a larger audience, which is what a brand audience is, right? It's a little more unsegmented. It's a little more broad. This is how you should consider looking at banks. And I think there's a lot of parallels to how job seekers say, it's not every job isn't the same. Some people are looking for a place where they can maximize their compensation. Some people are looking for places where they can do the most good. Some places are, people are looking for places where they can push themselves and test themselves or be supported or any number of things. But once you're top of mind, does that really set the frame for the rest of the conversation, or am I completely missing the boat there?
I think you nailed it. And I think in certain categories, there are what we call purchase drivers. So purchase drivers are the things that, think about them almost as the needs. There's a hierarchy of needs that consumers most need to solve. And certain brands own certain needs. So if you think within the world of telco, traditionally the top purchase driver within telco was coverage and speed. And this is why if you're a Verizon, or maybe not an AT&T, but more like a Verizon, their advertising and positioning didn't have to be that sophisticated, right?
Yeah.
It literally just said, you can get us, there's more bars everywhere, right?
Yeah.
Why? Because that is the top purchase driver. And when someone needs a telco plan, they know Verizon, you know, they even had the guy, right? Do you hear me now? Do you hear me now? Do you hear me now? And so that's the basic idea around positioning, which is, and you nailed on the head, which is, not every brand needs to own every single purchase driver, but different brands choose different purchase drivers which they can own. And this is precisely what we're going on, a bit of a segue, but this is precisely where T-Mobile, as number four, they couldn't own the top purchase drivers around coverage, reliability, or speed. What do? They throw out the playbook and say, we're going to go hard on customer service, which was traditionally a taboo within the telco industry. They position themselves as the uncarrier. They're going to rip up your contracts or give you free roaming. So, you know, that's a very salient, I think, example of, going back to your point, that not all of the purchase drivers are the same. Not every brand can own every purchase driver. And so positioning is really trying to carve out your pie, your slice of the pie, for certain customers in a way that is differentiated and unique and ownable.
Quick question. If you could increase the offer acceptance rate by 20%, what would that be worth? Or maybe get 10% more prospects responding to your recruiters, what would that be worth? Or lowering your ad spend and your agency spend by 15-20%, what would that be worth? I'm gonna bet it's worth a lot more than $1,500 a month. And that's how much it costs to build an employer brand, especially when you treat it as a subscription or employer brand as a service. If you want to learn more about how you can make these kinds of impacts almost immediately, check out employerbrandlabs.com. That's employerbrandlabs.com. All right, let's get back to the podcast. So connect the dot for me, because I really love positioning, because I think it helps kind of frame who you want to talk to, why you should talk to them, what you're offering them that's going to be compelling to them. But do you need a strong position to build a strong brand? Is there a correlation there, or a direct, you know, connection, or help me understand that?
Good question. So, and this also leads going back into your first question of the different types of marketing, right? The difference between brand marketing and performance marketing. I'm going to get to that by answering this question. So, in positioning, the idea of positioning really gained relevance and resonance in categories where the functional differentiation between one brand or the other, or one product and the other, was very minimal, right? So these are categories with lots of different competitors, and we can no longer say, I'm going to win because I'm the fastest, or I taste the best, or I we have the greatest performance.
It's the detergent issue. All detergents, clean clothes, roughly the same.
Exactly. And so in highly competitive, more mature categories, you need to have a more scientific way of saying, we're going to rally our brand around X. And those could be functional differentiators. They could be intangible differentiators. Think about, think about Avis, right? Avis was number two against budget. They couldn't compete on location or fleet size. So it was all about, we try harder. It's a service philosophy, right? Great example. Now, there are certain categories where these are new categories, where there is not too much competition at all. And there's one brand that just offers something that no one else offers,
right?
Think about Google in search. Think about Facebook. Think about a whole bunch of kind of tech companies over the last 20 years, primarily software-based, where they were trailblazers in essentially kind of a blue ocean, and they were the only brand in town. Think about Tesla. In categories like that, they don't really have to actively position, because they are the dominant brand. And yeah. this is primarily why Elon Musk, with all his kind of arrogance and bluster, said, I don't need to put money into advertising, right? But look what's happened. You know, let's say 20 years, you know, he didn't start the company, he bought into it. But 20 years after Tesla was started, OEMs have caught up within the electric car industry. There's a tremendous amount of competition now. Now, Teslas are being sold at discounts, and they're actively thinking about advertising. And now they're going to have to think about positioning. So it's a wonderful example of, you know, when do we have to start thinking about having a positioning, being more clear around what differentiates our brand, is in the presence of effing competition. And exactly. when there's no competition, you don't have to. But, you know, I would argue 99% of your listeners and 99% of marketers out there and people who work within the people space, you are in categories with competition. So you know, you better kind of start thinking about these things. Now, sorry, I want to go back to performance marketing though. Which was your original question, right? So your original question was—
Who can remember? This is so long ago.
Your original question was, what's the difference between, what are the two different types of marketing? So we start with brand marketing, right? So brand marketing was really broad. It touches everyone inside the category and outside of the category. Brand marketing is targeted at the 95%, right? And it's really important to do brand marketing because when I do enter the category, my brand's top of mind. What performance marketing is marketing that is targeted to people who are actively shopping right now.
Yep.
And the idea behind performance marketing is I want to elicit a specific sales behavior. So you see my ad, I want you to click it, I want you to buy. Right? So there's two main differences between brand marketing and performance marketing in that regard. One, the who. I'm going after the 5%, not the 95%. Mm-hmm. I'm going after the people who are actively shopping the category. And then the second one is the how. So whereas the HSBC ads with the World's Local Bank, I'm not trying to sell anyone anything. I'm telling a simple story about the company. When HSBC does performance marketing, they are saying very specific product-focused messages like our credit card gives you 3.5% interest, and if you click right now, we're going to give you a deal. So these are messages that are trying to nudge and drive a sale. Now, over the last, I'd say, decade and a half, performance marketing has been the belle of the ball.
Yeah.
And tons of brands have, what we have argued, is overinvested in performance marketing. And we don't have a beef with performance marketing. But the reason they've done it, and I actually am very critical of brand marketing, the reason performance market people or companies have overinvested in performance marketing is brand marketing has been terrible at actually articulating why it's useful, why do we need these things, and it's also been terrible at providing accountability.
Yeah.
Around where's this money going? What is the return? And so traditionally, marketers have gone to the business and spoken marketing gobbledygook in terms of, you know, what is this thing doing? Oh, it's gotten us impressions. We're changing hearts and minds. That's bullshit. Like, you can't take that to the CFO. You cannot take that to the boardroom. No one speaks that type of language. So there's been a dereliction of duty, I would argue, when it comes to brand marketers in terms of an inability to articulate its business value in a language people can understand. As a result, CEOs and CFOs say, no, we're going to put our money in performance marketing because they actually have data on how many people are clicking it and how many people are driving the sales.
Yep. You got a clear ROI. You, for every dollar spent, you get $3 in return. That is an investment you make every single day for as long as you can.
Exactly.
Until you can't, you start to over-index on the market and you're.
And that, I think that's the most important point. So your smart listeners will say, okay, well, what's wrong with putting all your money in performance marketing, right? You get all the data and it's going after the people in the category. The fundamental problem is it's you and everyone else.
Yes.
So you have a very small number of people where every single brand is trying to show their performance ads. And what is the kind of hidden secret of performance marketing? Performance marketing in the digital form, it works off an auction-based system, mm-hmm. right? So an auction-based system is, think about almost trying to buy an airline ticket on Expedia around Christmas, right? The price goes up, right? Around the popular times. And so performance ads, the way they work is different brands bid for keywords. So going back to my HSBC example, every single bank is bidding for keywords like high interest credit card or credit card with miles, so on and so forth. Why? Because when someone types those words in, because they're actively shopping the category, I want to be the performance ad that's shown at the top of the stack. Now, I have to bid and compete with all the other brands to get that top spot. What then happens? You have an inflationary environment where the cost to get that ad goes up. And so what has happened? Ad costs have tripled in the last decade. And as a result, the cost to acquire a customer, because fundamentally you're competing at the point of purchase in the most competitive environment, your cost of acquisition has gone through the roof. And this is precisely why all of these DTC brands, which were the darling of marketing, folks, oh, everyone needs to be like Dollar Shave Club. Everyone needs to be like Warby Parker. Everyone needs to be like Bonobos, Allbirds. All of these, this is a broken business model. And those are not my words. Those are the words of Andy Dunn, the former creator of Bonobos. So DTC is broken. Why? Because none of these companies are profitable, because their acquisition only relied primarily on performance marketing, and the cost to acquire a customer using these methods are now unsustainable. So we almost kind of, we go back, history repeats itself. So I think there's almost a reckoning happening right now in marketing saying, you know what, we need both brand and we need performance marketing. And by the way, when we do brand, we need to do it in a far more accountable and effective way.
Yeah. So if we go back historically a little bit, like pre-Google, pre-Facebook, it's when that auction model of direct action, direct marketing kind of took into place, where direct marketing meant postcards and letters. That was really the bulk of it, right? That was most of what direct marketing was. Email, I guess, before that. There was no auction system. So you could, the cost of sending a postcard or an email to somebody who was in market or out of market was functionally the same. But now that you've allowed digital to say, we can define that market very, very clearly, but now every single competitor is saying, ooh, that's the fish I want to fish in because that's where all the fish are biting. But turns out you are now competing with all that. That's what's pushed the prices up. So taking on a moving forward, it's about finding that balance of, look, the costs of direct marketing have gone up significantly. The value of it has dropped because of those costs. Seeding the lake with an empty lake with fish is how you create your own fishing spot, a place where you are the dominant player, or the place where you can have your message kind of be properly embedded in the minds of the people you want to reach. Is that a fair assumption? Am I drawing historical lines correctly?
I think you nailed it. I think the way I like to think about it is the closer you get to the point of purchase, the more expensive it is to acquire the customer.
I get that. Yeah.
You know, like if the way I think about it is imagine like a bazaar where there's, like a souk where you have a tourist walk in and there's a gajillion stalls and everyone's like, pick me, right? Yep. That's performance marketing. Yep. Because they haven't heard of your brand, you're competing with everyone else. Well, I'd love to be the stall that tourist already knows about before they've entered the bazaar.
Yeah, somebody told about them, somebody explained, hey, this is the best deal you're going to get, this is the best quality, whatever, totally. And I think employer brand, that tracks perfectly with, the way marketing thinks in recruiting and employer branding that, hey, if they're on a job board, if they are looking at my career site, if they're looking at my day in the life video, they are in market, hammer them, beat them up. But the truth is, if they're on Indeed, if they're on LinkedIn looking for jobs, everybody else can see them too. The second they've moved into that phase, they've raised their hand and become a target for anybody who wants to hire that kind of person. And it is a night and day kind of conversation between instilling the brand, why we're different, why we're interesting, versus apply here.
100%. I think I would also add to that, there are a lot of, I would say, legacy industries. Like one really good example is there's a lot of legacy industries who need to hire data scientists.
Yeah.
But data scientists don't find going working at that large pharma the sexiest thing.
Yeah.
Right? They want to go work at some software company or Silicon Valley company. And so there's a lot of these companies who A, need to go through a digital transformation, B, need the data engineering talent, but their employer brand stops them from attracting the right talent. Now, can you address that? Like, there's two ways to address that. Either at the source of the problem, by investing in employer brand marketing, Or are you going to deal with that when you're actively searching for candidates and overspending to get your employer ads out there because you have to show it to 100 data scientists to get one?
Exactly. And you're competing with some of the sexiest names in industry right now. Exactly. And you're quote unquote just a pharma. You can flip that, and this is just me talking out loud, right? This idea that data science is a great example because for the most part in, you know, the FANGs, the software companies, they're maximizing investment. They're maximizing a return. Hey, we're showing this video instead of that video because this video is going to generate us more money. The conversation that can happen on a biotech or pharma is that data science can save lives. And so that's where the employer brand makes the maximum effect. It changes the value conversation. It's not about, do I choose this soap or this soap because I like the bottle? It's about, do I want to maximize my income or do I want to save lives? The point or the purpose of employer brand is to help people choose your company as a place to work over other companies. Now put that way, suddenly employer brand doesn't seem so complicated. It doesn't seem so crazy. And it seems like something your company could take advantage of. And it is. Take a look at employerbrand.ing, employerbrand.ing, or employer branding, and you can find hundreds of resources, either free or dirt cheap, to help you understand what employer brand really is, how it really works, how to measure it, how to value it, how to talk about it, how to sell it to your boss. So check out employerbrand.ing for all sorts of employer brand resources to help you take advantage of your company's employer brand. And there's an audience who's going to pick one or the other every single time. And that doesn't always come through in a job posting. That doesn't come through in a career site when you're talking to nothing but data science, nothing but biochemists or biologists.
I think that's a lovely point. And I think it also shows that really good employer value propositions or employer brands feed off of the, let's call it the consumer brand of that biotech, of 100%. That pharma. And there's a really strong link between the two. This is an outside of category example, but I think if you think about Ritz-Carlton, right? They are the best.
Timeout. Greatest employer brand ever.
Oh, exactly.
I'm not even going to let you finish. I'll pull a full Kanye right there. That is the greatest employer brand ever. It is amazing. Yeah.
And the great thing about it is their employer brand is their consumer brand. It's the same thing.
Yes.
Right? So there's no cleavage between the two. It's ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen. Got it. It's done. You know, like take the award, go home, finish the podcast. We're
exactly.
done.
Exactly.
I think that's really for me, the big opportunity in that space is to think about, like, tackle the problem at the source. Don't tackle the problem when you need a candidate and you then have to overpay for it.
There it is. I love that. Let me. I'm going to throw a curveball at you. I'd love to hear your thinking behind it. It's not really a conversation I've heard a lot of people have, but from your perspective of what we're talking about, what you know about employer branding, is employer branding closer to B2B? Or is it more related to B2C? I can see arguments either way. I have a dog in this fight. I have a sense, but I'd love to hear kind of how would you kind of categorize this kind of marketing and branding? Ooh, I stumped the panel. I love it.
I'd say neither. In the sense that you need an employer brand in both B2B and B2C companies. I think the analogy would be it is a form of engagement to a select constituent. So it's almost kind of like, say certain companies need to do communications to potential investors or regulators. I just see it as one of those.
I see.
One of the companies we used to work for in the past, Shell, they have to do a tremendous amount of stakeholder engagement with fence line communities, with governments, with stockholder analysts. I would just say it's a form of brand building with a very select constituent base.
Makes sense. Can I get you for 5 extra minutes?
Of course.
Okay. You're a prince and a gentleman. I appreciate this. So one of the things that I know you are passionate about, that I'm passionate about, is the concept of challenger brands. This idea that you referenced Avis and Hertz previous about how the number two player was able to reposition themselves so that their position as the number two actually was a not a detriment. It was in fact, a huge advantage they could use. In employer branding, there is almost never an 800-pound gorilla in the room. Like in some markets, right? If you're in the ad market, it's Google and Facebook, and then there's 4,000 other players to be named later. In hiring, there are big players, Google, Facebook among them, but no one has hegemony over the talent market. There's no one big player. At its peak 5 years ago, you had the FANG companies who had the most attention, but they didn't hire the bulk or the majority of people. So there's no number one leader. There's no number one to kind of compete against. So it's effectively very much everybody competing for their own and on a fairly level playing field. How does a challenger brand, first off, that sounds like to me like how challenger brands approach the world, but at the same time, how can you use in challenger brand thinking in a world where there's no one dominant player?
That's a really interesting question. I didn't think about that. So I think I'll respond to it in a number of ways. One, you are right in the sense that if we define challenger brands as those with a smaller market share up against a dominant player, you're right. Those types of concentrated bell curves, but then a long tail of smaller players does not exist within the employer brand category. Fair. I think the way we often like to think about challenger brands though, is companies who have to do more with less, who operate with constraints.
Okay.
And the reason why we love that definition is one, it lines up with the definition of a strategy, which is strategy is sacrifice. But then two, I find that the best challenger brands, because they are up against a dominant player with more budget, and it doesn't really matter whether it's a dominant player or not, I'm going to show why it doesn't, is real effective challenger brands, there's a collapse between the brand and the communication, and then the product and the experience.
Okay.
It's all the same thing. So what's a good example of that? Let's take Red Bull. Red Bull, when they entered the US market, knew for a fact, made a strategic decision that we cannot, for our out of the life of us, ever be compared to soda.
Yeah.
Because if we do, we're just going to be up against Coca-Cola. We'll always be seen as a Diet Coke or a weird thing. We have to create this new space or category called energy drinks. And then from that brand strategy came a number of knock-on effects, both to packaging and to retail. One, the can is going to be smaller just to signal that this is a different thing. Mm-hmm. We're going to charge it at double the price point, again, to ensure that we're not being compared at all. And finally, you'll notice if you go to a convenience store or gas station, Red Bulls are never, ever in the soda aisle. They're completely separate.
Yeah.
And so how do we bring this back to the employer brand space? I would argue most people organizations in companies are terribly underfunded when it comes to media budget. They're getting the scraps, right? It is the consumer side marketing that owns the largest media budget, right? Mm-hmm. But really progressive people, organizations, employer brands have their own media budgets. That's how they are advertising their company. Now, assuming that you don't have that, then I think they do need to think like a challenger brand, which is how can we think about our employer value proposition? And yes, ensure it is activated across comms, but how do we take that singular idea and activate it across college recruitment? How do we activate it in terms of our induction when people go in to build word of mouth so that when they leave, they talk about it across all the different things that we do? And so your employer brand doesn't just become a comms device, it becomes a filter for decision making across all of those things. So that's how I would, that for me is a line between the two things.
Yeah. And to me, that connects really well because my definition of strategy is how are you making decisions? How are you filtering out opportunities from distractions, so to speak? And I think that ladders directly up to what you just said. So I think that makes a lot of sense. Faisal, I don't care if anybody listens to this podcast. I am blown away by this. I got a personal lesson from you. I got to stump you and got to watch you think through the question. And that's a gift. I appreciate that so much. So thank you for being here.
Thank you. I really enjoyed that.
And if anybody wants to get in touch with you at Creative Business Company, what's the best way to reach out?
Best way is creativebusinesscompany.com. Check us out on LinkedIn. I post quite a bit.
I love it. It's great stuff.
are at Creative Business Company, basically we help strategic marketers in typically brand resistant sectors. So these are organizations that are typically sales or product led growth or driven rather. And we help these marketers get their brand back in the black. That's our kind of line. And what that really is about is helping them transform their brand from a cost center to a revenue driver. And we do that in a number of different ways. And if anyone wants to get in touch, check us out at creativebusinesscompany.com.
Faisal, thank you so much for being here. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you so much, sir.